I think so. All right. We'll call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Monday, March 16th. We have a presentation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor on Managed Care Organizations Administrative Expenses. Just by way of orientation for members and the public, the reason we're having a hearing today, I know there's been several reports out and much discussion about it, but the reason and kind of the threshold when we decide to have a hearing is whether there's going to be an actual legislative proposal before us. The OLA has specific legislative recommendations that we need to consider, and so we'd like to pay kind of, we'd like to hear the entire audit, but pay particular attention to those items that we expect to be before the legislature this year. So with that, we have Jim Nobles and Valerie Bombach from the OLA. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, whichever of you wishes to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And as you said, with me is Valerie Bombach, who is the manager of this audit and evaluation. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in fiscal year 2014, the state of Minnesota spent approximately $9.6 billion of state and federal money to pay for health care services provided to people who qualified for one of the state's public health care programs. To help facilitate the delivery of some of those services, the state contracts with managed care organizations, MCOs, principally Health Partners, UCare, Blue Plus, and Medica. The state's relationship with these private companies is complex and controversial. Especially in recent years, the state has been accused of paying these companies too much, and the companies have been accused of shortchanging health providers and not being adequately transparent and accountable for the large sums of public money they receive, which includes about $300 million a year for their administrative expenses. As you may recall, the controversy over the state's relationship with MCOs heated up in 2011 and 2012, spurred on in part by UCare's $30 million donation, as it was characterized, to the state to help balance the state's budget. And things heated up because of allegations about MCOs' accounting practices from David Feinwachs, the former legal counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. In response to this swirl of controversy and allegations, Commissioner Jessen found herself not only in front of legislative committees here in St. Paul, but also in front of several investigative committees in Washington, D.C. And the United States Department of Health and Human Services sent a team to St. Paul to investigate Minnesota's MA program and specifically the state's payments to MCOs. In addition, the legislature enacted a law in 2012 that requires the Office of the Legislative Auditor to hire a CPA firm to conduct biennial audits of the information MCOs provide to the Minnesota Department of Human Services. As some of you know, OLA ran into considerable difficulty implementing this 2012 mandate. To address some of the concerns about what we did to implement the 2012 law, let me give you a quick timeline of what occurred. The mandate was effective when the bill was signed on April 28, 2012. But MCOs were not required to provide the data to be audited until January 1, 2014. So it was possible that OLA would not even start implementing the audit mandate until late 2014 or early 2015. But we decided to move ahead, and in early 2013, we began to work on a strategy to ensure that we would effectively use the $1.7 million that the legislature appropriated to OLA to hire a CPA firm. As we were developing that strategy, the Legislative Audit Commission added to our MCO assignment. In April 2013, the Commission directed OLA to also conduct a review focused on MCOs' administrative expenses. We decided that it would make sense for OLA to coordinate these two assignments. The mandate to hire an audit firm and the directive to review MCO's administrative expenses. I put Valerie Bombach in charge of both because of her deep knowledge of MCOs and her experience auditing and evaluating healthcare management issues. In July 2013, we issued an RFP for audit services, and we used various social media to make CPA firms aware of the RFP. For our efforts, we received just one proposal to audit the financial records of 8 MCOs. After reviewing the firm's proposal and interviewing the principals, we hired the firm. I signed a contract with the firm on October 16, 2013. We then started immediately to get the firm working on the audit. Unfortunately, early in that work, we discovered that a principal from the firm working on the audit had a conflict he did not disclose to us. After confronting the individual and officials at the firm with the issue, we decided to cancel the contract. This was deeply troubling and frustrating. It cost us months of work and put us back to square one. Rather than try to issue another RFP, we decided to take 3 OLA financial auditors, assign them to Ms. Bombach, and do the best we could to fulfill both the 2012 mandate and the audit commission assignment. The result is the report that is in front of you. What does that report tell you? First, the report confirms yet again that the accounting rules that govern the allocation of administrative expenses to public programs are extremely complicated, sometimes vague, and therefore subject to varying interpretation. Second, the report tells you that both the legislature and DHS need to be more prescriptive and clear in defining what administrative expenses are allowable when they're allocated to public programs. Third, DHS needs to strengthen its ability to examine the data that MCOs are periodically submitting to the department. So that leaves us with the question, is there still a role for OLA and an outside audit firm? Yes, absolutely, if that's what the legislature wants. OLA will go back and try again to obtain the services of a competent and conflict-free firm to fully carry out the 2012 mandate. But that kind of looking back, and sometimes in that work we're looking 2 years back, that kind of work should not substitute for DHS taking a harder look at more current data coming into the department. With that, Mr. Chairman, I want to turn to Ms. Bombach to give you a summary of our report.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Bombach, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Valerie Bombach, the project manager for this audit and evaluation. And Tyler Billig, Valentina Stone, and Carmen Mark Patton, financial auditors from our office, also worked on this report. And before I get started, I'd like to bring one issue to your attention. This audit and evaluation involved working with data that the managed care organizations have identified as not public under Chapter 13. Some work product by the Department of Human Services actuary also was flagged as proprietary. The report in our presentation today is framed to comply with data practices requirements, and under these circumstances, state law restricts how much information and analysis we can provide or discuss today regarding our financial audit work or about managed care payment rate setting. And on one other point, some have questioned why we are currently treating the managed care organization's data as not public and are not questioning such classification. On that point, we could have taken 2 approaches to this work. We could have stopped what we were doing and stopped the audit and focused on testing the classification of literally hundreds of documents, or we could go the route of putting together findings and conclusions for policymakers to work with, and we chose to go with the latter. Our work involved auditing the financial reporting by the 4 largest managed care organizations that the Department of Human Services contracts with for the state's public programs. That is Blue Plus, Health Partners, Medica, and UCare. We used a more targeted approach than would have been used, say, for a financial examination for the Department of Commerce. We were asked to look at and test administrative expense data on three key financial reports that the managed care organizations file with the state and that the Department of Human Services looks at when determining managed care payment rates. Our scope of work included all administrative expense transactions in which at least some portion of the expense was allocated to a state public program. We did not test commercial-only transactions or medical expenses, and we did not look at Medicare-only expenses. Our objectives included testing the consistency, accuracy, and completeness of reporting, as well as the managed care organization's allocation of costs across all lines of business, that is, both commercial and public. We pulled a sample of transactions from each managed care organization's detailed administrative data for the year 2012, and that was the data that we worked with. For some types of expenses, we looked at the extent to which they were separately reported to the Department of Human Services for rate-setting purposes, and we also reviewed the Department of Human Services rate-setting methods as they pertain to administrative expenses only and the department's review of this managed care data. For some context for our discussion today, for contract year 2012, the total reported administrative spending for the state's public programs by these four entities was about $278 million, including taxes. And that is, these are expenses for all state public programs: the prepaid medical assistance program, Minnesota Care, Minnesota Senior Health Options, Minnesota Senior Care Plus, and Special Needs Basic Care. And this total represents spending for about 6.6 million member months. When comparing trends in managed care administrative spending, the total reported administrative costs per member month in 2013 were comparable to 2009 for PMAP and Minnesota Care and increased about 8% for MSHO and MSC Plus. And as we discuss in our report, we attribute this trend to a number of likely factors, including competitive price bidding, legislatively imposed caps on trends, changes in rate setting by the department, as well as changes in the managed care organization's service arrangements. I'll start with an overview of several broad conclusions from our audits of these four entities, and then I'll expand on our findings in the following slides. The actual audit reports and the managed care organization's responses are located in appendices A through D in the back of the report. So to begin, for the samples that we tested, we found that the entities generally complied with accounting principles when classifying and categorizing administrative expenses, but with some exceptions. We also found that each of the entities could have allocated some expenses more directly to specific lines of business, that is, specifically to commercial or specifically to a public program. And this is a requirement in state law. For some of each entity's subcontracts for administrative services, we found inadequate supporting documentation. We also questioned some costs allocated to the medical assistance programs, and these costs were not otherwise disclosed to the Department of Human Services for rate-setting purposes. First, we tested how the managed care organizations classified and categorized administrative expenses on their annual financial statement, and there's a particular document. It's referred to as the Underwriting and Investment Exhibit Part 3, and this summarizes all of their administrative expenses by class, such as general administrative, cost containment, claims adjustment, as well as category, and that would be salaries, taxes, rent. It's grouping into various types of expenses. So for this, we first tested for the purposes of understanding how it might affect DHS rate-setting purposes. And for the state's public programs, correct categorization is important because the state's actuary and DHS handle certain types of expenses differently, either for rate-setting purposes or for contract negotiations. We tested, were administrative expenses correctly classified, meaning were they correctly classified as administrative and were not classified as medical expenses. We also tested, were administrative expenses correctly categorized? That is, were salaries reported as salaries, were taxes reported as taxes, was travel reported as travel? For the samples we tested, we found the following exceptions among the managed care organizations' reports of overall administrative expenses. That is, these are the total expenses before they've been allocated across lines of business to commercial and the public programs. And we found, for the samples we tested, we found a small number of transactions miscategorized to the incorrect expense line, that is, salaries, taxes, and so forth. However, these total related costs for each managed care organization ranged from about $1,700 to $3 million. I'll point out that the discrepancies here did not affect the overall reported costs at the bottom of this exhibit. It's just that dollars were put in the wrong category line. However, we also found one transaction valued, we estimated, at about $2.8 million that was misclassified as medical rather than administrative, and that means that this amount did not appear as an administrative cost on this exhibit. For this item, we think it's possible that the misclassification impacted the department's rate setting for managed care payment rates. Some of the transactions we tested were related to subcontracts for administrative services, and that is the managed care organizations can contract out with vendors and consultants to provide a wide array of services, both for overhead as well as specifically for the public programs or specifically for their commercial products. And among the samples we tested, we found a lack of documentation for these types of transactions. Specifically, some subcontracts were not fully signed. They had expired, there was no contract, or the payments did not align with the contract rates. And for these type of cost items, we found 2 to 4 exceptions per managed care organization. We were also asked to look at how consistent the managed care organizations are in their reporting. And we found some key differences in how the entities define various terms. These terms are cited in law, and we think a lack of definitions could have contributed to some differences in their reporting. Specifically, there is an accounting requirement that the managed care organizations directly allocate costs, and directly allocate means that costs are attributed to the product or program that benefits from the service. We also found differences in how the phrase product or program was interpreted. The question might be, is a program the medical assistance program in Minnesota Care, or does program mean the PMAP program and MSHO and MSC Plus? We also found differences in how they had interpreted the phrase charitable contribution, and that is an item that was specifically classified as unallowable for rate setting purposes during the 2013 legislative session. Among the samples we tested, we found that some expenses could have been more directly allocated. Again, that is, state statutes require that the managed care organizations directly allocate expenses to specific lines of business or products when such information is available. We found examples where they could have more directly allocated to either commercial or a specific public program on the reports filed for 2013. Among the samples we tested, there were about 2 to 5 exceptions for each managed care organization, and these types of expenses were really contract-related and not broad general overhead expenses. The managed care organizations have complex cost allocation models, and we found that based on a review of their policies, their accounting procedures, their allocation practices, that they did not restrict certain expenses that we considered unreasonable or inappropriate from being allocated to the public programs. In our view, these types of expenses did not meet a prudent person standard. They were unrelated to approved medical assistance services or were out of compliance with the Department of Health rules. The types of expenses we questioned included costs for services or activities outside of the state of Minnesota and that were unrelated to either a commercial or a public program product here in Minnesota. And the Department of Health rules require that those dollars be put in a separate bucket. We also questioned expenses that were allocated to the public programs that were for alcohol, travel, and entertainment. And these types of expenses are not explicitly disallowed in law. However, we employed a prudent person standard in examining these dollars. The number of these exceptions that we found for each managed care organization ranged from 1 to 3. To emphasize, under current law, the managed care organizations are not specifically restricted from incurring some of these types of costs, but they should not be allocated to public programs, and we think that they should be disclosed for the Department of Human Services for rate-setting purposes. However, these expenses were allocated to the public programs on state reports, and we found that they did not otherwise disclose these costs to the Department of Human Services during 2013, when the department requested data from the managed care organizations and began developing payment rates for 2014. And this leads to our findings regarding the Department of Human Services. During 2013, as part of the department's rate-setting activities, we found that their directives and requests to the managed care organizations regarding their administrative expenses were too general to address data complexity, data integrity, and variation among the managed care organizations' allocation and accounting processes. And again, they have very complicated allocation and accounting methods, and we feel that their directives just did not adequately take that into consideration. We think that the lack of specificity likely impacted the consistency and completeness of the data that they did collect. However, we also found that the department implemented some important cost-saving initiatives to target savings in the public programs, and they did this in two ways. First, through competitive price bidding. This was first implemented in 2012 for the 7-county metro area, and then again in 2014 for 27 other counties. And from our review of the actuary's rate setting documents, we see that competitive price bidding had a multi-year impact on rate setting, at least for the administrative portion of the capitation payment rate. The department also changed its rate setting methodology for computing the administrative portion in order to target savings specified in state law. And there was a provision in law 2013 that was intended to target $47 million in savings. However, the department did not execute some statutory options to limit administrative costs when setting the managed care payment rates. In particular, there's a provision in state law that limits annual growth in administrative costs by each managed care organization. However, the department feels that the current language is technically incompatible with some other provisions in state law, and we'll address this later regarding one of the recommendations that we have. One other option pertains to handling investment income. That is, the department, there's a provision in law, the department is required to handle investment income the same way that it handles investment expenses. And lastly, the actuary did not exclude administrative expenses that would be considered non-state plan approved costs when the department was developing the payment rates. We have several overall conclusions from our audit and evaluation work. And one of our conclusions really relates to the ongoing controversy over the source of the data that's been used to develop managed care payment rates and what is done with that data. In the past, the department has relied in large part on data that's reported to the Department of Health by the managed care organizations. The Department of Commerce conducts financial examinations of the managed care organizations, but these examinations really involve a higher level review of their data that does not necessarily focus on the needs for public program rate-setting purposes. And it's really this configuration and these circumstances that has been part of the call for, first, more independent audits of the data and for more enhanced reporting directly to the Department of Human Services. To address these issues, we think that more detailed statutory definitions and requirements, as well as Department of Human Services contract language and instructions, first, would diminish controversy over the allowable expenses for the public programs. These actions would enhance financial audit work moving forward. It should improve consistency and compliance in the managed care organization's financial reporting. It should help assure that unreasonable administrative expenses are excluded when developing managed care payment rates. And lastly, we think restrictions on allowable medical assistance expenses will require independent data verification by DHS that is ongoing during the rate setting process. We have several recommendations for managed care organizations, the legislature, and the Department of Human Services. And I'll start with our recommendations to the department. We think that DHS should enhance reporting instructions, definitions, and technical guidance to the managed care organizations. The department also should enhance managed care contract language, in particular, language regarding the subcontracts for administrative services, and reporting requirements in the templates that are used for certifying the data that they do submit. Just tell
me. Ms. Baumbach, could you pull your microphone a little closer, I guess, just for the recording, I guess.
There's this one.
Thank
now
you.
Now can you hear? Okay.
That is better, actually.
Okay, sorry.
Lastly, we think the department should implement ad hoc audits of administrative data, in particular, the unallowable expenses that are specified in state law. For most of the managed care organizations, we feel we are not able to sufficiently verify during the audit the extent to which these unallowable expenses were reported to the department, and we think more work in this area in terms of guidance on how to segregate these expenses and report them to the department would be a good thing to do. Lastly, we think the department should focus on data that is reported directly to the department pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 256B69 as Subdivision 9C. This is the new financial reporting requirement in law. We also have recommendations to the managed care organizations. For the administrative expenses that administrative services that they do expense to Minnesota's public programs, we think the managed care organizations should fully report their expenses and investment income in accordance with accounting principles and state law. They should directly allocate costs to specific products when such information is available. We see opportunities for doing so, and in fact, the managed care organizations do this for certain Medicare services. They should retain adequate documentation to support the subcontracts for administrative services. And we think that the managed care organization's work involves handling sensitive and not public data, and that their contract practices and documentation should align with this charge. Lastly, we think they should fully identify and report to the Department of Human Services unreasonable and unallowable costs for rate setting purposes. Again, we found that the managed care organization's accounting and their allocation practices did not appropriately discern certain types of expenses from other MA-approved costs, and they did not otherwise disclose these items to the department. We think sufficient time has gone by since the new law that specifies unallowable expenses was passed, and that the managed care organizations now should have integrated changes to their accounting practices to fully identify and segregate these costs. Lastly, we have some recommendations to the legislature. We think that it would be good to amend Minnesota statutes to expand language regarding how managed care organizations must allocate administrative expenses and investment income. And in particular, we think any amendments should further define what is meant by program or by product. There's a couple areas in state law where this phrase is used, but it's not really clear if we are down looking at individual medical assistance products or just medical assistance in Minnesota care in general. The law should be amended to further define certain types of unallowable expenses for the medical assistance rate-setting purposes. And for this, we think that more definition regarding what actually is a charitable contribution should be more clearly defined. Also, we found that there's disagreement between the MCOs and the department regarding the interpretation of the amount of compensation that is allowable. There's a provision in law that places a restriction on any expenses over $200,000, and we think that there's a disagreement over the interpretation on that. refine managed care administrative spending limits for the public programs. Again, we think first that this law should be clarified whether this limit is an aggregate or is it per program. Also, the department and thanks, and we agree that the language should be modified to more closely align the statutory language with their current rate-setting methodology. Specify managed care organizations' data certification requirements. That is, to clarify language first to meet federal requirements as well as language that is expected within the contracts. And we found differences in the Department of Human Services reporting templates as well as the managed care organization certification documents. Lastly, we think it would be helpful to define in law the terms for the managed care organization subcontracts for administrative services that are expensed to the public programs. That is, what exactly is the form and content and what are the expectations for that? That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair, and I would be open to answering any questions.
Ms. Baumbach, I've got a couple of questions. Going back on our slide, we have six per, and I noticed that we didn't test to the medical side. But then on the first slide for the audit results, you had an estimated $2 million misclassified as medical. And that would have actually had an effect, that portion would have had an effect on the rates. But how did you come across that? I mean, because I thought we weren't testing medical, and I'm just trying to understand the extent of the audit and what might be left undone.
Mr. Chair, yes, so to clarify the methodology piece, we looked at the administrative expenses that were reported, checking to be sure whether or not they were truly administrative expenses and shouldn't have been in the medical expense bucket. We also looked for expenses that we thought should have been included in the administrative expense bucket. And in doing that, we looked at past CPA reports. We looked at their service arrangements to gain an understanding of what we would expect to see in the administrative expense bucket. So on that particular item, we did verify with the managed care organization that item that would normally be in the administrative bucket had moved to the medical side.
Okay. But it didn't come through a sampling of the medical side. Do you have
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Do you have any sense as to whether we would find more of this were we to sample over on the medical side?
Mr. Chair, I certainly think that would be an appropriate focus of a follow-up audit.
Okay. And then another kind of key piece, you mentioned early on in your presentation that you had kind of a limited time and available resources to focus your attention, and there was an issue about data classification, and much of the data came classified in a manner in which you wouldn't be able to disclose it, and you could either have chosen to fight that designation on multiple fronts with probably hundreds of documents, or you could have done the best you could to give us good advice. And I think this does have some good insights for us. But maybe any insights you might have into why you didn't look at that other path and what we might find if we start pursuing that a little bit. Is that
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Nobles.
That's an issue that is before the legislature.
Okay.
And that's an issue I think you should settle because it's a matter of law. So I think, the best route to resolve that issue is right here at the legislature rather than us fighting it through the courts.
Okay. Well, we need to tease that out here to help best understand the issue before us. One final, and I'm guessing there's others that have questions as well, and we'll get to those in a minute. But in the background section of your full report on page 11, we have the managed care administrative expenses by category, and one of the categories just jumped out at me, regulatory and government compliance / lobbying. Are we really paying with our public programs for the MCOs to come and lobby us here at the legislature? I'm not certain that's a good idea.
Mr. Chair, we did, in fact, that was an item that we looked at trying to understand. Again, the managed care organizations can, there's nothing that restricts them from incurring that cost on some level, but what we did is we looked at the extent to which that information was disclosed to the department for rate setting purposes. And so we did ask for data both from the department as well as looked at data, their detailed expense data. And they, you know, we would say that they disclosed a substantial amount of those dollars to the department. And in our view, then it's up to the department to decide how that is incorporated into the payment rates moving forward.
Okay. All right. Other questions of members for the OLA staff? Senator Carlson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nobles, we talked, reported some questions about charitable contributions, and I see that on the pie chart it lists charitable contributions as 6%. Can you give me a feel as to what some of those might be?
Ms. Bombach?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we did take a look at that. Again, just to be clear, I'll generalize in part because that has been classified as trade secret. But the types of expenses include things like research grants, promotional charity events, grants to other nonprofit entities. Grants to promote employment opportunities. That might be another one. So,
Ms. Bombach, is this...
I feel at this point, if I were to give more information, it would disclose the nature of the contribution. Again, it's been classified as trade secret.
That's good. Interesting. Senator Carlson, a follow-up?
Yes, and I guess what I'm looking at here is if this is 6% and our total is that we were looking at was $278 million, so we're talking about almost $17 million worth of charitable contributions that have been flowing through these accounts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Ms. Bombach.
Yes, I would say that. That's in the range, yes. And Mr. Chair, Senator, just to clarify, this was an item that we sought to verify the extent to which they had disclosed this to the department, and we have some recommendations. There's a little bit of a glitch in time that, you know, we would say that we would ask the department to request from the managed care organizations, what are your total expenses as allocated to the public programs. And we felt that we were not able to sufficiently tie out those numbers.
Senator Carlson? Yeah,
Mr. Chair, I have more questions, but I'd like to let other people
share. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, you mentioned a conflict of interest that made it impossible for you to complete the next piece of this work. Can you help us understand what a path forward might be? I'm guessing that most of the major accounting firms have some significant level of engagement with the managed care organization. Do you have advice for us so that we could help you complete your task?
Mr. Nobles?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, and certainly I'd like Ms. Bombach to talk to this too, because she spent months and months of work trying to deal with, develop first an RFP, solicit proposals, review them. And it is a real barrier to fulfill the mandate that, as you just indicated, many of the firms have ongoing business with the managed care organizations. And we felt that it was very important because of, as you well know, Senator Benson, generally accepted accounting standards, that independence be of prime importance. It was something actually that the legislature emphasized in the law as well. It is certainly of prime importance to all of the work we do with our own staff. We impose a very strict independence disclosure on all of our staff. And we, in fact, took that independence disclosure document and told the firm that made their proposal that they would be subject to that as well. Let me just remind you that in the law that you passed in 2012, you gave this firm the authority of the Office of the Legislative Auditor to do this work. So one of the reasons we felt obligated to really be directly involved and engaged and not just hire a firm, send them off, and say good luck, do the work, come back when you're done, is that you gave them the authority to work under our name. And we were giving them, potentially, a significant amount of public money. So we made competence and independence equally important. Yes, there are firms out there that have the competence, but independence is going to be a struggle. Now, as to going forward, all I can do is try again to put an RFP out there. I would say the firm that we hired, we would not reconsider because as much as we were disturbed by the independence impairment, we were particularly disturbed that it was not disclosed. After all of the time we took to talk to them about the importance of full disclosure, if it had been disclosed, frankly, we might have been able to find a way to work around it. But once that that very important principle of trust is broken, we were not going to go forward. And we discussed this, as I said, with the top officials of that firm, just so they would understand what had happened. And they agreed with us that the engagement that was involved that was not disclosed should have been disclosed, and that it did create an independence impairment. So that's kind of a long answer, Senator Benson, but it is going to be a challenge. I know that there are many people who think this is what we need to do. We need to go out and hire a firm to do this work. We are willing to give that another try. If I could just add one more point, Mr. Chairman, while I'm talking. You gave us the $1.7 million. Interestingly, we think that that's not enough to get all this work done. When you appropriated $1.7 million...
It's not all that interesting to us. Everybody says that.
Mr. Chairman, when you appropriated $1.7 million for us for one audit engagement, I was astounded. In our world, that's a lot of money. That's a heck of a lot of money. And yet, I thought, well, wow, we can do a lot with that. But when you go out and try to hire these firms to do this amount of work, in their world, that's not a lot of money. So we may have to have a conversation. If you really want to go forward with this and do this work at the level it needs to be done with the number of organizations where it needs to be done, you may need to invest more than that. Now, as I've told the chairman, we did not spend that money. And we were prepared to give it back. We spent about $100,000 to hire an actuarial firm to help us with this assignment. But we did this assignment and developed the report in front of you out of our own budget. We didn't charge any of our salary costs or any of our overhead costs to the appropriation because we felt like we were not fulfilling the mandate that you gave us when we had to fire that firm. So again, Mr. Chair, excuse me for the long answer here, but there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle that maybe at some point we need to talk about in some detail about how to move forward.
Yeah, I'm trying to piece this together. I mean, what I'm hearing is, truthfully, that maybe the recommendations in here aren't quite enough to move forward with, and I'm just working calendar through my little pea brain here and thinking it's first deadline week. We better get some of these ideas queued up sooner rather than later. Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Bombach or Mr. Nobles, I'm still perplexed at the charitable contribution piece and having taxpayers pay for 6%, or is that $17 million, correct me if I'm wrong, and not being able to know what that money is going to is perplexing. Can you at least perhaps
enlighten us as to, did you see that 6% across all the plans that you were looking at, or maybe more on one side or the other, just so at least we can know or to pinpoint where that money is being used more likely on charitable contributions? Is it UCARE, Medica, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or Health Partners?
Mr. Baumbach. And Senator, so just to be clear, it's the items that we tested were primarily between Medica and UCARE, and for those, there's a split there, and we do have that detailed in the report. And to clarify, for UCARE, we felt that we were able to tie out and determine that they did significantly disclose that to the Department of Human Services for rate-setting purposes. So that was the larger amount. And then for Medica, we felt that we were just, it was very challenging, and we felt that we were not comfortable saying that they had significantly disclosed those items to the department.
And Senator Franzen, sure. A follow-up, but we're going to have the Council of Health Plans up here, too, and I'm plan on asking them what the trade secret rationale for charitable contributions is. I mean, I think I saw many puzzled faces around the table as that answer was delivered, and so we'll have to ask them. And but a follow-up,
sure.
Senator Franzen?
And that'd be great, because disclosure means that we know it went there, but we still don't know what's covered in that bucket. So to the extent that we're able to fix that legislatively, too, I just think that's part of transparency and disclosure of taxpayer dollars, where they're going. So I'd love to hear that from the plans.
Senator Benson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could go back to the previous question for Mr. Nobles, do we need to amend the 2012 request in some sort of scale and scope, perhaps within the $1.7 million appropriation, so we can get an idea of how big the problem might be? Because sometimes legislatively we dig in, we ask for the whole shoot and match, and we don't need that right away. A review versus an audit to give us some sense of how big the problem may or may not be. So if you could advise on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator, just to clarify what would be really helpful in the law, and it is this. The way that the law is written, it's a very tight spec, and it does not give us, it gives us very little wiggle room. We did have inquiries from other entities.
Just to be clear, we're talking about the law that asked you to do this study.
Correct.
Yes,
correct. Well, to do the ongoing financial audits.
Yes.
And so in thinking about that list, some of that is, those items are probably better looked at by an actuary. However, the way the law is written, it must be an audit firm that meets the standards of Chapter 326A. And, you know, there's lots of very qualified CPAs out there and firms that have, for example, financial examination firms that have very qualified CPAs within them that would be able to do the work and are familiar in this subject area, but it does not meet the standard as written in the law. So if we could loosen up that language to allow us some flexibility, that would be, you know, what we would want to do is get people that are very qualified to do the work. At the end of the day, that's what we think is important.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just like to
Mr.
echo
Nobles.
That with Senator Benson in particular, because with all due respect, to me, no offense, but I think this law in 2012 was put together by folks who didn't completely understand the audit world. And I think that there was a bit of feeling that, well, if you hire a CPA firm, that's kind of the gold standard, they'll get the job done. But, you know, as Ms. Baumbach said, you know, there may be firms that don't fit the licensure under the firm, but have people who are qualified. We also think it would be better not to leave it to hire just one firm. I also think, and if, I think I understand what you're suggesting, Senator Benson, that maybe we ought to break this into parts, and we don't need to go everywhere to all of the firms all at once, or all of the managed care organizations. And by the way, the law also called for us to go to the county-based purchasing plans as well. We didn't do that either. So again, I think the folks that put this together just really didn't have a full appreciation or understanding of what they were mandating to be done. This was the result. We weren't able to do it.
Mr. Nobles, Ms. Baumbach, but these recommendations that you're talking about here for structuring this law restructuring this lot to allow you to do better ongoing. That's not part of the recommendations that we would find in this report. Is that correct?
That's
that
correct, Mr. Chairman.
If we're going to choose to kind of stay on this path and have the OLA continue to do this audit, we would need some additional work. So just so that we're clear, that would take some additional technical support from probably DHS and the OLA to try to restructure that. And so I think that's important.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. And you bring in DHS, and I think that is very important, too. And we think that we ought to work with DHS and legislators to refashion that law. And we do have recommendations about DHS that would need some changes in the law. So I think getting together, folks who understand this world, certainly there are many here at this table in the legislature, people at DHS, and from the experience that we had with Ms. Baumbach and her team, I think would be very valuable. I just hope those who originally crafted the 2012 legislation would be willing to be supportive of our efforts rather than think we are trying to undermine what they were trying to accomplish. I think we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, and that's greater transparency and accountability. The question is, what is the best, most cost-effective way to get there? And I don't think the law that was written in 2012 is that.
Okay. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Baumbach, when I hear the term charitable contributions, I think of certain things. But I would like for you to define for us what exactly we're talking about in charitable contributions in terms of this discussion.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that the way that the language is right now, it says charitable contributions. It doesn't expand on that. When we did our audit work, we looked at the law prior to the change was broader, and it addressed monies that went for research or scientific purposes, educational purposes, or to a charitable organization. And that is something that is allowed under 62D. So the newer law, when it was passed, it replaced the old law that referenced that broader definition. So the way that it is now, the law is vague. It just says charitable contribution. And in our view, we think that more descriptive information would be helpful in terms of what all should be encompassed within that. Is it everything that's allowed under 62D, or is it just a contribution to another charitable entity? It's not very clear what that is.
So, Ms. Baumbach, the 62D reference, so this is where we would find the research and things, maybe
correct.
Some money to the University of Minnesota or the like?
Yep, so, again, the law that under 256B69 that refers to the unallowable expenses, which lists the charitable contributions, that replaced a previous law that referred to the broader definition. And so now it's very open and it's very vague in terms of what should be included within that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might suggest too to Senator Brown.
Mr. Noble.
It goes back to, I think it would be helpful for all of you to hear what the managed care organizations consider to be a charitable contribution, and maybe you could go through that list with them and see if you agree, and maybe mark off some where you might disagree and put that in the law, that kind of contribution, although they may consider it a charitable contribution, is not allowable.
Chair, and to the testifiers, does each managed care organization hold the same definition of charitable contributions, and within that definition, are political organizations considered charitable contributions?
Ms. Baumbach?
Mr. Chair and Senator, in terms of, yes, that's an item that we felt there was a lack of consistency in terms of what might be a grant. Would you consider a grant to an entity to be a charitable contribution? Mr. Chair and Senator, I don't recall anything that was classified under a charitable under that phrase charitable contribution as something that would be considered political. And again, that is just within the samples that we identified and captured.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Baumbach, so is it possible that a managed care organization could consider a political contribution a charitable in this category?
Senator Brown, are you talking about a C4 entity or an actual political, like to a candidate?
I'm talking about any political organization, a candidate, a party. She's saying that we're lacking transparency here, and we've kind of opened this up, and I'm just questioning if there were any political contributions, if this is a part of that.
Ms. Baumbach?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I don't believe that we identified anything that would be characterized as defined as a charitable contribution in that bucket. I'm not saying that it's not possible that they could have, maybe the health plans could speak to that.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Baumbach, your bucket necessarily wasn't full of information. You didn't have complete information. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Baumbach.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we pulled a sample of over 100 transactions, and we looked at purposive and random sampling. And to the extent possible, we did include purposive sampling for the charitable contributions. Again, just to be clear, in identifying those expenses, it's possible that something was not coded as a charitable contribution, and as such, we may not have captured it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I might just add,
Mr. Noble,
the folks around this table in front of me are much more knowledgeable and expert on what qualifies as a political organization than we are. And there may be even some variation in your consideration of what is political. It doesn't obviously mean just a party. It could mean an organization that has an agenda that that is brought forth to the legislature that you may consider political, but they may not. For fear of offending, I'll just throw out, I mean, some people would consider the Sierra Club a charitable contribution. Others might consider that as an organization that has a political agenda. So I think, you know, again, you might sometime, if you're allowed, the law has changed and you're allowed to see what those contributions are, you could again sort of go through the list and see if you think anything qualifies under your definition of a political organization.
Well, I think that one of the things, the one that might be, would be the 501c4s that are relatively new to the scene. And did you see any of those? Those are the ones that work on issues and take contributions that are not otherwise disclosed.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I couldn't fully answer that at this point. But I do think that this is a conversation that needs to be had in terms of defining in law what should be and classified and coded and reported to the Department of Human Services for rate setting purposes.
Okay. Any other questions of members? I know we want to hear from the plans, and there will probably be some questions there, and we want to hear from DHS as well. Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Baumbach, there was, the fifth slide, there was audit results, and at the bottom it said an estimated $2.8 million misclassified as medical rather than administrative. And I'm wondering, I didn't really get the feel that was a one-time issue, or was that an average, or was that a, you know, how did that come out, and were there outliers that you found? You know, we're obviously looking at four organizations, and were there outliers that had particular problems in a particular area?
Mr. Chair and Senator, so to clarify in this first item, this the way that we went with our sampling is we tested transactions, any transaction over $500. We don't do statistical projections. Rather, what we do is we take those samples and we use them as indicators. That is, it's an indicator of accounting practices and their allocation practices. So we would verify against their policies, their accounting policies, as well as their board policies, how they would handle a certain type of transaction. transaction. So we treat them as an indicator for that type of expense. And then with that, we looked for likely related expenses. And so for on this particular item, the initial transaction that we looked for probably would have been small. But then we went out and we estimated what we think would have been all expenses related to that type of cost. So that is where we draw the $2.8 million from. That's comparable to the way that we came up with the $3 million for the miscategorization. We would have just sampled a very small transaction, but then we went and we looked for all likely related costs to that item.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Can you help me understand, just following up on Senator Carlson's question, when looking at audit results for organizations that are managing resources of this size, I would expect that there are always findings when you do a review, and so it's hard for me to know if what you're describing here is what is commonly or regularly seen when you take a look at an overall organization, that there is going to be, I know in healthcare there's, we struggle with trying to determine if we've categorized things correctly or if we've misclassified things when we're billing for charges. So I think that that reality exists and is going to be found in all audits. So to me it's more about, is this significant or is this in line with what you might often find when you're doing these kinds of audits?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, so just to clarify, for example, on the expenses that we thought were unreasonable and unrelated to the managed care organizations, they are small transaction items. However, for each of those, again, we went back and we asked about their allocation practices, how those types of expenses went through their models, how they handled those types of expenses for accounting purposes, and we think that they're not mistakes, it's what they do, and so all expenses would have been handled the same way. With respect to, you know, we'll talk about the miscategorization. Yes, it's probable that there's going to be some error, some misclassification. Obviously, they handle, you know, tens of thousands of transactions. It's for us, the larger items are the items that probably matter, and they matter for rate setting purposes. So again, that's where we try to go out and we try to determine the magnitude of that type of expense. Another reason we are sort of down in the weeds here is if we had done this testing and we found all of the errors in for one particular type of expense, and I'll pick one, travel, if they were all within travel, or maybe they were all within software, we would also look to see perhaps some of the error has to do with lack of guidance or explicit definition for recording that type of transaction. It could be unclear instructions. So we are aware of that. You know, and obviously there's going to be, we would expect to see a small amount of error. However, the large items are the ones we think that are important.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add a little bit
Mr.
to that, because we do a lot of audit work, and we deal in a lot of situations that are very complex. State's accounting system is complex. A lot of the rules around allocating money. You know, I think of, for example, going to a school district and looking at their accounting practices, and you know, they too have to allocate certain money to certain activities. They have a lot of dedicated accounts. So you're going to find problems. We find this sort of thing over at the Department of Natural Resources, where you have certain buckets of money. You can only spend out of that bucket for a particular thing. And sometimes definitions are a little vague or they're just errors. I think one of the things, though, that needs to be said here, because I really do think it's important that we are dealing with organizations that are private organizations, and many of these MCOs have significant amount of business in the private marketplace. Mm-hmm. So they're working on very complex accounting that tries to keep straight, you know, their commercial business from their public business with the state and public money. And so I think sometimes they work in an environment where they don't sometimes maybe see the distinctions that would be made if they were a purely government organization. Draw the comparison. We have county-based purchasing organizations run by public employees under clearly standards that are for a public government organization. they would probably immediately think, we can't spend public money on that. But if you're a private organization, an MCO, you're spending money on that all the time, on certain kinds of travel, contributions, alcohol. The question is, are you spending it out of the public bucket of money or out of the private money? And that gets to be part of the complication here. What I think needs to occur, among many things, is just a stronger emphasis when you're dealing with public money, whether you're an MCO or you're a county-based purchasing, it's public money. And there are certain restrictions that are going to apply. You can't spend public money on certain things, no matter who you are or what you're doing. It's a little more complicated, admittedly, for the MCOs, but that's the reality of the business they're in. They're taking a lot of public money to do good things and provide service, but they just have to keep better track of that money and not spend it on certain things.
All right. With that, I think we will probably move on and bring up the health plan, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, to offer their insights into the report and its findings. Members, just by way of orientation, we are not taking public testimony. We do need to be out of this room by 10:30, so we have a ways to go, but I did alert the public to submit any testimony that they wished to offer in writing, and so you will have a packet. There are some good insights in here that we value as well. And if this results in some legislative proposals that are before us, of course, those will be vetted with public testimony at the time. We're trying to make sure that the legislature gets this audit and understands it to the best of its ability to figure out how to respond, and then we will have, I'm assuming, some legislative proposals, and we will get to the point where we're taking public testimony. With that, in your new role, Mr. Showalter, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm a president and with the Minnesota Community Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Excuse me, MCHP. Just so you know, and just for background, MCHP is the trade group associated for the nonprofit managed care plans in the state, serving more than 600,000 people in public programs. And the organizations play an important role. As you know, they're the conduit to provide access for public programs so that they are accessible to people across the state. They're there to provide efficient and billing and administrative services, and ultimately to manage costs and risks associated with the programs. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on this report, Mr. Chair, and just to provide some feedback. We particularly appreciate the difficulty of the task that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has undertaken. It is a complex, it's a large business, and certainly the OLA's office has put a significant amount of work taken a collaborative approach to try to figure out and understand the work that the plans undertake. And we're committed to working with them, with the state, to continue improving delivery of healthcare services. The audit in general, I think, showed that one of those questions that's been lurking out there, how much admin costs are there in public programs? Is this a large number? Is it growing? What's the shape of it? The information that you provided by the OLA, as well as corroborated by the Department of Health in a recent report, is that admin costs are actually declining over the last several years. Managed care organizations 26%. Have been holding down administrative costs, and for public programs like PMAP, GAMC, and other programs, they're actually lower than they were 4 years ago, and that's just good news for all. The audit did underscore the need for greater clarity in reporting requirements. The plans agree that the findings that there's difficulties in reporting and that there's inconsistencies based upon this 2012 data. We're also pleased, though, to note that DHS has already taken action and the legislature has already taken action to start to clear up some of those issues. For instance, legislative changes were made in 2013 regarding community contributions. That DHS has implemented enhanced quarterly and annual financial reporting in 2014 that requires detailed breakdown of medical and administrative expenses. DHS has also made revisions to the requirement in 2015 to require additional information and instruction. And finally, in the contracts that are currently out, DHS has clarified the definition of allowable expenses in that procurement contract. So as difficult and substantive as the OLA report is, I just want to help make sure that we're all on the same page. Work has continued to go on within the state, within the plans, to continue improving the process, making sure that the information that's available to the legislature and that the intent and expectations of the legislature are continually, we're doing better and better towards fulfilling that. In moving forward, council members will continue to work with DHS to address the report findings in the most direct manner possible. But there will be complications. These are independent organizations that are subject to state and federal regulations, independent of what DHS's instructions. The state programs are about a portion of the $20 billion a year healthcare revenue and spending by health plans. But that said, we will work with the state to make sure that we have a reporting environment that's effective. We will do our best to make sure that total administrative costs are minimized and that the information that is necessary for both regulation and rate setting is always available. So to close, the Council of Health Plans appreciates the work and recommendations provided by the OLA. Improvements are already underway with this report in hand. We should be able to get back to work with DHS to provide additional templates, improve future reporting needs, and ultimately move to the key issues for healthcare, improving affordability, accessibility, and quality of healthcare in the state.
So a couple of questions likely from myself and from members. And in listening to the OLA's report, I think that the big piece that they led with was, everything that they achieved came with the designation of trade secret. And they decided they didn't have the ability to take that on and do the analysis. We're going to need to get behind that trade secret designation a little bit more clearly, because obviously I think you can hear from the questions of members. There's a real need to get deeper into this and have the transparency that we expect when making an investment of public taxpayer dollars. And when it's applied to things like charitable contributions, possible lobbying, there's a very serious issue here. Can you get behind the blanket statement of trade secret that apparently everything that was given to the OLA came with?
Mr. Chair, members, I think the topic of what is trade secret, what is in the public domain, is obviously one that was before the legislature, and that is going to be, I think, clarified one way or another by this legislature or in the future as requests come out and it's clear what kind of information is out there. So I think part of what you're looking at right now is just a lack of specificity and a difference in opinion based upon which plan you're talking to about what is, at this point, trade secret. I should say that the information that was sought of contributions is part of the NAIC filings, and it is also reported to DHS. So for rate setting, for regulation purposes, this information is available in the hands so that for oversight purposes, this information is already available.
But not for us or the public exactly where the contribution went. And let's just take one plan. I'm not going to name anybody, but a plan that thinks that charitable contributions are a trade secret of their business. Spell that out for me. It's just not clicking for me.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I believe that this is something we should understand and talk with you to help understand with the specifics of that particular situation. In general, I think you would find that the charitable contributions, that information is already being provided to DHS. It is already being provided for rate setting purposes. And ultimately, that the charitable contributions function of these organizations, because they are nonprofit, that is part of what they're supposed to be doing. So that is a part of the nature of what they're supposed to be doing. I understand the status of information that you're referring to, and we can certainly follow up.
We're going to need some follow-up. I do understand that's the community benefit portion of being a nonprofit, but I mean, you know, it was called out, the issue of, you know, you characterizing research as a charitable contribution. So, I mean, we're giving taxpayer dollars to fund research to gain, you know, competitive advantage, and come back and work with the legislature. I mean, I just need to call it out. This is what we're hearing here at the table, and it's troubling to many of us. And so I think that we're really going to have to do a deep dive and figure out. I didn't really hear much of an answer for why how these could be considered trade secrets. I mean, I still just don't quite get that. But I won't monopolize the time. Anyone else have questions? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Showalter. I guess there are a lot of things that I have concerns about. Trade secrets. What are the categories of these trade secrets? If the veil is continually, it's a trade secret, we're not going to talk about it without any understanding for the purpose. Is it negotiated contracts with providers? I could understand how that could be a trade secret. But we need to have some very direct conversations without disclosing or violating. It feels like when you continually say, no, that's a trade secret, that's a trade secret, it's an attempt to not be transparent. And it builds distrust, which means we dig deeper and we push harder and we don't actually accomplish the goal of reducing the cost of care. I know that the plans are at a disadvantage because we have the power to make or break them. We are the legislature. We do stuff all the time. So I respect that there's going to be some pushback. When it comes to charitable contributions, I do not believe, and someone will have to disprove this to me, I do not believe it is the role of our taxpayer dollars to make charitable contributions in the name of another entity. Homeless shelters don't also make charitable contributions. You're a nonprofit that exists for a public good. We can debate whether that's appropriate for a healthcare entity or not, separate conversation. I just don't feel that billing back charitable contributions, whether it's research, whether it's a health run at the Mall of America, whatever it is, it's not the taxpayer's job to pay for that. So my door has been very open to the plans. I would really appreciate it. If it can't happen at this table, I would like a walkthrough of what some of these things are and why they cannot be discussed and why the legislative auditor can't see them and why the taxpayers who pay for it can't see it. I guess it's more of a statement than a question. We have to hear from DHS yet today, but I don't think that you should be asking taxpayers to pay for anything that they can't have a good look at, and I'd like to hear a reason why we can't have a look at them.
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I appreciate the concerns and spirit in which your comments are made. And just a couple of things. One is that certainly this audit is a very detailed, specific look. And so in some respects, I think following up and talking more about transparency is a very natural next step, because the audit is a step towards transparency. It is a request and a very specific study of what's going on in the plans. And you've had a team of people looking at the details of what's going on in the plans for a period of time. So additional transparency concerns, I understand, and we'll get back to you on that. But I also say that the act of the audit is actually a significant step on transparency and should provide the committee with some assurances and some understanding that professionals from the OLA have looked at specifics that usually don't come to this level. And two, the nature of the community benefit and what's going on. In terms of charitable contributions, it was something that was addressed in 2013. And so part of this is about what was happening in 2012 as opposed to current practices. And so would be happy to get more specifics on that for you as well.
I think that would be helpful. I mean, I'm going to try this one more time. The whole concept of community benefit is kind of opposed to the concept of trade secret. Trade secret, by its very nature, is something that provides a competitive advantage, that if disclosed, an entity would lose their competitive advantage. That's not a community benefit to protect a place in the marketplace for an individual company. That's not a community benefit. That's a company benefit. That's a trade secret. A community benefit is something that the entire community benefits from. And so, you know, I mean, this whole issue is, you know, I mean, you're tax-exempt organizations. That's true. We don't collect taxes. But one of the things that you need to do is provide a community benefit through charitable contributions. And if we're characterizing the charitable contributions as trade secrets, coming with it the designation that we're protecting our interest, you're getting a lot of pushback, and that's not going to end. We need to get behind this a lot better. Any other questions of members? Senator Carlson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'd like to support what you just said, that when there are trade secrets, when there are contributions, when there are administrative costs, when there are these kinds of costs being allocated to the account that actually winds up being setting rates, I think that makes it, you know, especially inappropriate.
Yeah. Now we've got, that's the link that is, okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, we'll thank you, Mr. Showalter, and we will turn to DHS. I know that Commissioner Jessen apologizes. She's traveling to Wilmer today to take a look at some of the programs that are proposed in the governor's budget that we all encourage her, making sure we have a thorough understanding of those proposals. And we have Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner, to present, and members have sort of a one-page, two-sided status of OLA findings from the Department of Human Services regarding the recommendations that were for the department. And again, the OLA had recommendations for the department, recommendations for the MCOs, and recommendations for the legislature. This will be the department's take. Deputy Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members. Thanks for inviting me. My name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I want to start by thanking the legislative auditor, Ms. Bombach, and the team for a great audit that dug into what are some very complicated issues, as the conversation here today has illuminated, looking at one of the largest expenditures in the state of Minnesota, and certainly one of the largest in our budgets and the largest contracts that we have with a private entity, and clearly an area that needs this kind of examination as we move forward. I just want to review a little bit, and actually Mr. Showalter did some of this for me, but talk about what we've done over the last 4 years in terms of looking at the managed care, both from a procurement standpoint and from an oversight standpoint. It has been a high priority. The moment Commissioner Jessen came in January of 2011, this was the top thing on her list to start digging into. And as folks here are aware, that was done in terms of procurement changes, competitive bidding, the 1% cap that we put on HMO profits in 2011, as well as some other legislative initiatives that were to put limits on growth in the managed care organizations' costs for public programs. And this was very much a bipartisan effort over the course of the last 4 years, the legislature and the department working together on how to do this. And also has been covered very thoroughly here, increased oversight of managed care organizations, including audits that the governor ordered in 2011, which helped illuminate some issues for us as we move forward. with our work at DHS. And of course, one benefit of all this is that we have greatly reduced the cost of managed care, and that was clearly a huge benefit for us during the deficit years of being able to get savings in this part of our budget without having to reduce eligibility and benefits for the people that we serve. As we look at the snow, we acknowledge that there's a lot of work here yet to do, and certainly the audit highlights some of those issues that we need to continue to work on. And we appreciate the suggestions that they've made, and we solidly support all those recommendations and findings in the audit and want to move forward working with the legislature on making progress in each of those areas. I will direct your attention to the chart that the chair referenced that the department has put together and just highlight a few items here that we have both already put in place and the work that we need to continue to do. I want to highlight, first of all, and I think this is important for folks to remember coming out of the previous conversation, that in 2013 the legislature did put some additional limits on administrative expenditures, including prohibition against counting charitable contributions as part of how we do our rate setting for DHS, as well as we exclude lobbying expenses from what they can report to us as an eligible administrative expense. And so those things fall out of the 2013 law. We implemented them to some degree in 2014, much more so in our 2015 procurement, and even more so as we put out our RFP for procuring the entirety of the state for 2016. So we made progress, and you can see it kind of highlighted here in the middle column on the first page of this document. Of this chart showing the steps that we've made over the last couple of years, including trying to get at this definition of product versus program that was raised in the audit, clearer definition and more reporting around the limitation on the $200,000 limit on salaries, clearer definition around what counts as a charitable contribution. And all these are areas that we have, you know, progressed toward and made clearer definitions in our 2016 procurement than we did in 2015, than we did in 2014. But we also acknowledge there's probably still work that needs to be done, and looking at the audit will help us as we go forward in making progress. And you can see that more in the right-hand column of where we identify areas that we still continue to look at for further definition. Also, in number two on this chart, the contracting issue, this is an issue that's already called out in our contracts with the MCO, is the subcontracts need to be in writing, need to be fully executed contracts. I'm certainly concerned to have seen the finding from the auditor that was not always happening, and it's something that we'll look at as we go forward. And then finally, I want to emphasize this third issue. It has to do with audits, and there's been some discussion here with Mr. Nobles and Ms. Bomback about auditing going forward. We can have really good laws in place that are really clear, and we can do what we can to try to make our contracts clear, to try to make our procurement documents clear about how things are categorized and how things are defined. You still need to have that level of oversight. You still need to be able to get out and actually look at what's going on the ground to ensure that those definitions are being followed, or to identify areas where definitions need to be strengthened or clarified, and to work with people on trying to ensure that that happens. And so we do support this recommendation and note that this would require additional resources for DHS to take on a stronger audit function here. And I think as the previous conversation has illuminated, what role DHS has versus other entities in the overall audit work that needs to be done, I think is an area that needs discussion going forward. But this is an area that we feel strongly about and want to move forward on ensuring that we have a capacity to provide oversight for the work that's done within these managed care contracts. Mr. Chair, with that, I can take any questions.
Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Johnson? Okay. Well, any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, I think that concludes our business. We stand adjourned. Thank you.